Chinook, it's a warm wind.
It's a changing wind.
Chinook, a program for and about Alaskan natives.
Chinook Echoes is looking back into Native heritage.
How things are and how they got that way.
Chinook Patterns is information.
Issues that affect the patterns of Alaskan life.
Chinook Profiles, portraits of people, places, events.
But mostly the people who are Alaskans.
Welcome to Chinook Patterns. I'm Paula Schiller. The Alaska Native Women's Statewide Organization had its second annual convention in Fairbanks not long ago. The convention suffered growing pains and all the problems inherent in a new organization. But for the keynote speaker, it chose a woman who was a veteran fighter for Native women's concerns. Mary White Eagle Natani is a Winnebago Indian from Wisconsin, and she's president of the North American Indian Women's Association. She addressed the convention wearing beads in her gray braids and a dress made of deerskin. Here is an excerpt from her speech.
As I was coming on the plane yesterday, I was looking through the airlines magazine and trying to get some idea of what I would call my speech. And you're talking today about your culture and your traditions and the strengths that come from these cultures and traditions as a way of tackling or addressing some of the very serious concerns and problems that we face in our societies today. So I would like to address my topic to a future in the past. I first want to talk to you about, tell you a little joke. When we Indian people go to these various conventions, even though we're interested in promoting better public relations with all peoples, we usually find ourselves talking to ourselves. And I think this is one of the real problems that we Indians face in not being able to communicate effectively with other societies. There was a story about several non-Indians who live in Washington State. They got tired of hearing of fishing rights and water rights and treaty rights and Indian sovereignty and self-determination. So they said, when they were getting ready to go on a vacation, they said, let's go someplace where there are no Indians. Okay, where shall we go? Well, let's see, how about Montana or South Dakota or someplace? No, there's a lot of Indians there. Well, how about New Mexico or Arizona or someplace down there? No, there's a lot of Indians down there too. Well, how about Massachusetts and New York? No, I'm afraid there's Indians up there too. Well, how about Florida and Mississippi and North Carolina or someplace down there? No, I'm afraid they're all over that damn place. So an Indian who was standing nearby said, why don't you go to hell? There's no Indians down there. I'd like to tell you a little bit about myself so you'll know where I'm coming from. I am a full-blood Winnebago, and I'm proud to say that I still speak Winnebago. And I have stayed with my Indian religion, the religion in which I was brought up in. Despite the fact that I went to the Winnebago Indian Mission School in Neillsville, which was a boarding school, where we were told that you had to join the white churches in order to be saved, I stayed with my religion because that was what I saw as my whole way of life. And this is what you're talking about today. What is there in our past that we could use to continue in the future? We talk about culture as if it were something abstract. It means running around in your tribal dress, in your beads and your feathers. Out in Washington, they think that all the Indians out west still running around in beads and feathers. But that's just the surface, that's a tangible thing. When we're talking about culture, we're talking about a way of life. And I maintain that there cannot be a culture without a religion. And this is one of the reasons that I have hung on to my religion. Because even though I went to school and I was forced to go to the organized churches, I was not able to relate to those, what they were teaching. Okay, what does the Indian religions, or even the word religion is misleading, because if you're talking about a way of life, I think spiritualism is a better word. Because in the Indian thinking, we're brought up to believe that there is a pattern, a universal pattern. The Indians talk about the circle, the sacred circle. That circle is a cycle of life. It says that you start at one point in your lifetime, you go complete circle, and you return to that circle from that point from which you started. There might be times when you're going to get off this circle. Those are the times when you run into difficulties in your life. But as long as you stay on that, in that circle, that road, they say that you're going to get to salvation, the kind that the white organized churches talk about. And in this universe, there's a pattern into which we all fit. So they also teach that you've got to live in harmony with all the forces around you, the forces of human beings, the forces of nature. All of these you have to interact. And if you don't interact effectively or meaningfully, then you're going to run into problems. And these are the kinds of problems that we're running into now with the breakup in our families, with the alcohol and drug abuse, with domestic violence. All of these problems, there's something wrong someplace where we've lost track, where we've gotten off the path that we were supposed to be traveling on. The other factor is that in the society that we live in the educational system, there's a tremendous conflict there. In the educational system of the greater society, it's individual. You're supposed to worry about yourself as an individual person. Never mind the rest of the people. You're supposed to elevate yourself to whatever degree your skills will take you. But in the Indian world, if you'll excuse the expression, we're taught to be our brother's keeper. We're group-oriented. I don't worry about myself. I worry about my family. I worry about my tribe. I worry about the whole Indian nation, and therefore the whole nation and everybody else. That's the way we're taught. So that immediately when a child goes to a school, there's conflict already in the way that they're being taught in the educational system, which says that you have to excel in book learning, because someday you're going to have to work. And when you work, you want to make the most money so you can drive the best car and live in the best home and wear the best kinds of clothes. This is foreign to the way we were brought up. When we're supposed to be concerned about what happens to us as a group, and this is where the breakdown in our societies begin, where the breakdown in the families begin. In the white churches, I hate to be critical, but that's the way it is. We're taught that you've got to read the Bible. You've got to do unto others as they would be done by. All of these teachings which we see, which we hear, and yet we don't see that practiced. So the breakdown in our families continue. As women, we're caught up in all of this. In the Indian society, we're the nucleus of the family. What happens to that family is on our shoulders. And yet, even in our roles, we talk about what were our roles in the past as compared to our roles now. If we can go back into history, let's say back to 1492, when some boat people came over here. They dealt with us in the way that they were accustomed to, which means that they recognized the men as the leaders. When you consider the Iroquois Confederacy, In the Iroquois Confederacy, it was the women that laid down the law. It was the women that chose the representatives to speak for their tribes. So these foreigners came over here and they recognized the men as the leaders. And from that time on, the roles of the Indian women has been deteriorating. But as usual, as is according to the way we do things, when something happens that doesn't quite agree with us, rather than standing up and fighting for it, we let it happen. We sit by and we say, well, we don't want to rock the boat, so we don't do anything about it. So that's the way we've been going along. So now here we are in the present. Where are we? I mean, what are we supposed to do as Native women? In my own organization of the North American Indian Women's Association, there's been a big quarrel there among us. There's the old guard that says, according to our traditions and our cultures, Indian women were not supposed to go out of the home to get educated to go to work. And there are the militants like myself who say, yes, we must. In my own tribe of the Winnebago Indians, we enjoyed a lot of freedom. I can do pretty much what I wanted to. I never was told that because I was a woman, I couldn't do this. I wasn't told because I was a woman, I have to be a secretary or a nurse's aide, or that I have to stay home and raise children. I belong to a clan that has leadership responsibilities in the tribe. A long time ago, when the Indian tribes were being pushed out west, there was no such thing as sex discrimination or discrimination against the elderly or discrimination against the handicapped. When we were running away from the United States cavalry or from missionaries or from educators or whoever we were running from, or even moving to our winter campgrounds or the hunting campgrounds, there was a division of labor. And that division of labor was not based on whether you were a woman or if you were old or if you were young or if you were disabled. There were certain responsibilities that were assigned to groups of families, and these were the clans in that tribe. So that when a tribe had to move hurriedly, it was very well organized, very well coordinated. It could move on a minute's notice. And I guess that's why we're still alive today. But that's the kind of society we grew up in. This society which tells us that we live in harmony with nature. Some people say that we're nature people, and I really believe that. Several years ago, during the longest walk in Washington, which was a spiritual walk, I heard some of those leaders say that if there is ever a destruction of the Indian people, or if there is ever a total destruction of the animal life, that the other one was going to disappear also. And I think that's really true. That's how close we are to living with nature. And even though my brother-in-law is Miles Brandon, and I have a niece and a nephew that are half Winnebago and half Eskimo, I try to learn what I can about your culture up here. And basically, when you consider, there's tangible differences, but when you think of the very basic values that we were brought up with, I think that there's a lot of similarities. You people up here feel threatened because there's limitations in the things that you were accustomed to, your whaling, your berry picking. We had those down in the southern states also, but we don't do that anymore. In Wisconsin, we used to be picking in the summertime, canning, putting away food for the winter. We don't do that anymore. Now we get all of our food from the supermarkets. So there is a drastic change in the way we are, the way we have to live, the way we're forced to live, I should say.
An excerpt from Mary White Eagle Natani's speech to the Alaska Native Women's Convention in Fairbanks. I'm Paula Schiller, and this is Chinook, a production of KUAC FM at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks.
Thank you.
Chinook, it's a warm wind.
It's a changing wind.
Chinook, a program for and about Alaskan natives.
Chinook Echoes is looking back into native heritage.
How things are and how they got that way.
Chinook Patterns is information.
Issues that affect the patterns of Alaskan life.
Chinook Profiles, portraits of people, places, events.
But mostly the people who are Alaskans.
Welcome to Chinook Profiles. I'm Paula Schiller. Mary Tallmountain is a poet. She has a round face, no wrinkles for her 50-odd years, short brown hair, it's straight, and bright brown eyes. She looks like she'd be at home in her native Nulato, even though she hasn't lived there since she was a small child. She was born Mary Damaski, became Mary Randall by adoption, and chose to be Mary Tallmountain as a writer. She told me how she came to leave Alaska so long ago.
I was adopted by the white government doctor and his wife, and at 3 years old, and taken to the outside for a while. And I wasn't able to assimilate into the culture at that time, so they brought me back up to Alaska. And we went out onto the Aleutians and lived on Alaska for a couple of years. And then we went to Dillingham for a couple of years there. So I didn't go to the native schools at all or the government schools. My adoptive mother was a teacher, and she tutored me at home. So I didn't really actually go to any school as such until I came outside and was 12. And entered a public school.
So you went from living at home pretty much in Alaska and being taught by your mother into a public school in where? San Francisco?
In Atascadero, California. Mm-hmm. We went to a very, very hot place from the cool of Dillingham right down to one of the hottest places in California, I'm sure. But I managed to assimilate well then, by that time. At the early age, I wasn't able to.
Do you know why, what the difference was?
No, I don't. Well, I think there was one problem, and that was that they had me on a stage and dressed in my Alaska clothes, parka, mukluks, and mittens, and I was just intimidated by the faces. And then afterwards, the children came up. I think it's incorporated in that poem. The children came up and then began the lifelong business of you live in an igloo and you eat blubber and you're an Indian, you know. Mm-hmm. Actually, I'm a fourth Indian, a fourth Russian, a fourth Irish, and a fourth Scotch.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. That's the Indian that stands out. Or mm-hmm. That's one.
I took after mother and my parents, and so. But I feel all of the races, you know, in me.
Would you just interrupt things here? It would be really nice if you could take a look at the poem that we were talking about that has that. It's called Indian Blood.
Some noise here.
You have to get your glasses.
Mm-hmm. Well, the Indian Blood.
The Indian Blood one, because that was just what we were talking about.
Yes, we were talking about that. The blackbird teacher, white claw waving, stalked the stage. I stumbled, my muckluck caught on a slivered board, rustle of stealthy giggles. My midnight mittens of velvet, crusted with crystal beads, dangled from brilliant tassels of wool wet with my sweat. The teacher's voice was loud, from the land of the midnight sun. All of them stared at me. For the first time, I felt their flowing force. Did she ask me to speak, or did I crouch there like a rabbit in the curious quiet? Somehow, at last, it was done. They butted and shoved to the stage. Questions darted. Do you live in an igloo? Fingers pointed. You eat blubber. Ha, ha, ha. I was ringed by ribbons and ringlets, hair like brass, grass pale, eyes. I shivered. The silken furs of my parka trembled. In time, I got away, and toward night, I crept into a closet and bit my hand till it was pierced with moons of dark Indian blood.
Now that's something I assume that you didn't, at that tender age, sit down and write that
no,
poem.
No, these were reminiscences done later when I had time to write, because I was quite busy making a living in the early days. I became a legal secretary and worked in San Francisco for about between 20 and 30 years, and then established my own public stenography business in San Francisco, which I ran by myself. And that's a sort of an adjunct to this type of work. I developed cancer due to pressures and so forth, I presume. And so that was the end of the working life. I had to retire early. And there was one benefit. I could write, finally write. So that's what I've been doing ever since, and publishing in small literary journals and in a good many Indian periodicals and books. I haven't published anything of my own yet.
Having been outside for so long, and really your formal education being in the public schools and things, how come you're an Indian writer or a native poet?
Well, it's because that's the subject that I thought of most. And then, of course, I had a great deal of correspondence from my mother until she died, from my brother until he died. And my foster mother, my adoptive mother, kept a very exhaustive journal of all the events that happened in Alaska. And, of course, Alaska was the place that I really thought of. I suppose you would call it my spirit's home, Alaska. So I came up here to Alaska in 1976, and I've been coming up in the summers ever since then.
Mm-hmm. When your reminiscences and your spirit home is Alaska, is that because you're just early memory from living here, or do you think it's really in your bones, in your genes, and in your blood?
It's a combination of both. I think we all have that pull toward our roots. And nowadays, of course, much more is being said about roots and genealogy than ever before. There is some need in people to go back to find out who they are. But I've had that all the time. I always, you know, felt this was the place where I would eventually be and, you know, live and write. So I'm trying now to get into the winters so that I can live up here in the winter.
So you think after all this time you could come back? How do you think?
I feel that way.
Do you have family connections in Nulato? Would you be accepted back? Could you?
I'm pretty sure that I would be. I belong to the Domoski family of Alaska, and those were Russians that came up the river, I guess, back in the 1800s, and settled. And then now there's a large group of them. I stay with one family in Anchorage when I'm here, and one I just met a lovely family of mine, part related to me, first cousins, I guess, in Holy Cross. So I keep running into people. But I'd kind of like to live by myself. I have a little cabin by myself, really. Because, you know, writers want this privacy.
How much of the language, looking through some of your poems, you do use what I assume are Athabaskan words. Is that, are those things that you remember from your childhood, or
no,
they've had to go back and look up?
No, I had to research for that. It's not, and I can't pronounce them. I don't, of course not, don't speak the language, but I try to check them wherever it's possible to you know, get the correct things. And I don't use a great deal of it, you know. I'm writing a novel, by the way, based on a fact in the 20s, and it will be containing some Athabascan conversation. But I don't use it except in context, I mean, where it's necessary. I think that, you know, where it conveys the Indian feeling and sense, that's where I use it. But as far as speaking it, no, I haven't, and I might try to learn it someday. I'd like to.
Does it run into a problem with the poetry, though? You have a poem where you, if you don't know how to pronounce it...
Well, when I read this poetry, you see, I don't use those words because it wouldn't be correct, would it, if I mispronounced it?
Okay, so you read around them.
Mm-hmm. I read around them, and then when they're printed here, they're visible, and there is a visual impact.
This is a long one, but it has that in it, and I can't pronounce the title either, or some of the lines, but it translate out to Indian women.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. All right, I'll read that one if you like.
Please do.
All right. Grandmother, in lamplight, chewing hide with gleam of teeth, Matmia, my mountain grandmother. Small aunt, I hear you talk in falling leaves of dying summer, crouching by your sister's pallet, hands outstretched while the women chant, for mother suspended alone, harshly breathing the Yukon wind. Tend for me your father, you say, mother, your words, misty as rain on the river. I tell you, I will walk in your shoes. You and he will soon embrace, with older brother and young brother. Ah, I want to sing how older brother would build a sled, how young brother would play to us music for a night of snow. All I am of woman is what you give when you say to me in dreams, shadowed we come, whom you thought not to find, once in illness, again in the green heart of our land, now at the rim of the great mountain. Gently, tall mountain, repeats your words, stirs reptilian limbs, moves ochre stones to set a period to the line. Wait, you are not alone. Indian women, you, my other selves, through every feathered pore, your bright spirits inhabit my present shape. Lead the way, into the light.
Mary Tallmountain. She read from poems collected in an anthology called The Remembered Earth. I'm Paula Schiller, and you've been listening to Chinook, a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks.